This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, May 30th, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Aura Bogado. President Bush announces his pick to succeed Paul Wolfowitz as head of the World Bank. Congress members and business leaders descend on the hemisphere's only communist nation for trade talks. And President Bush requests $30 billion to continue his HIV/AIDS program. Some critics are worried about how he'll spend the money. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Sharon Young with today's headlines. Thailand's constitutional court today ruled to disband the Thai Rak Thai Party and bar more than 100 of its members from participating in electoral politics for 5 years. The party had been in power in Thailand until a military coup ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra last year. The court found Shinawatra and his party guilty of violating Thai election laws. Thousands of troops are on hand in Bangkok, and the interim prime minister has threatened to impose a state of emergency in the event of political unrest. In Somalia, the security situation has further deteriorated today with an attack on a convoy of Ethiopian troops in the central part of the country. A number of civilians were killed after a roadside bomb injured Ethiopian soldiers. Abdurrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
Ethiopian soldiers killed at least 4 civilians and wounded dozens more when they opened fire on a crowd in the city of Pelatwen today after an explosive device detonated near their military convoy. The number of Ethiopian casualties is unknown, as the troops cordoned off the area and denied access to journalists. No one has claimed responsibility for today's attack, but an Islamist group opposed to the presence of foreign troops has vowed to wage an Iraqi-style insurgency against Ethiopian troops backing the Somali government as well as African Union peacekeepers. Some 1,500 Ugandan peacekeepers are currently stationed in Mogadishu as part of the African Union peacekeeping mission. The AU had hoped to have 8,000 peacekeepers on the ground in Somalia to replace the Ethiopian troops, but most of the AU peacekeepers have not yet arrived due to financial constraints or security concerns. 4 Ugandan peacekeepers were killed when their convoy was hit by a roadside bomb early this month. The Ethiopian government has said that it will not withdraw its soldiers as long as the AU peacekeepers are not fully deployed, an exercise that could take months to complete. For FSRN, I'm Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
An Israeli unmanned drone today killed 2 members of Hamas's armed wing in the northern Gaza Strip. The Israeli cabinet has decided to step up attacks on Hamas and Islamic Jihad and what it says is prevention against homemade rocket fire into Israeli towns along the border with Gaza. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
The Israeli decision to increase air raids in Gaza came after Palestinian President and Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas proposed a mutual ceasefire with Israel. Israel rejected the offer. Medical sources report that 2 members of Hamas's armed wing arrived at the Kamal Adwan Hospital this morning, physically torn apart after an Israeli unmanned drone fired missiles at the Jebali refugee camp in northern Gaza. The past 2 weeks, scores of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza have claimed the lives of at least 52 Palestinians, including 80 children, while Palestinian homemade rockets have killed 2 Israelis. In the West Bank, the Israeli army continued an arrest campaign targeting Palestinian legislators and ministers. Israeli soldiers yesterday abducted the Fatah-linked lawmaker Jamal Tirawi in the city of Nablus. President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert are due to meet on June 7th within the context of a series of bi-weekly meetings, the most recent of which was cancelled due to ongoing violence. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
The Bush administration is set to proceed with drastic increases to immigration application fees. As of July 30th, the cost of the application to become a U.S. citizen will double, while fees for permanent residency will more than triple. The cost of bringing a fiancé will go up by nearly 270%. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that handles citizenship and residency applications, receives 99% of its operating budget from user fees. Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, has become the latest college to cut its ties with Coca-Cola after a student campaign raised concerns about Coke's human rights and environmental record. Sevilla Mann has more.
Smith College informed the Coca-Cola company that it will be barred from competing for the college's beverage contract when it is up for bid this summer. A letter the college released yesterday states that Coca-Cola failed to convince a committee of students, faculty and staff that it has addressed issues of labor repression and environmental damage at its plants abroad, and that by ending its relationship with Coke, Smith hopes to influence the company to change its behavior. Union organizers in Colombia have accused Coca-Cola of ignoring violence committed against employees at its bottling plants there. Several communities in India say the Coke bottling operations depleted groundwater reserves and polluted farmland and water resources. The allegations, which Coca-Cola denies, have sparked an international student movement against the company. Smith now joins about 40 other colleges and universities worldwide that are officially boycotting Coca-Cola products on campus. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sevilla Mann reporting.
Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The U.S. has nominated former trade representative Robert Zoellick to serve as president of the World Bank. Zoellick will replace Paul Wolfowitz, an ex-military official and architect of the Iraq War, who was forced to resign after an investigation found he used his position to arrange pay raises for his girlfriend. President Bush announced Zoellick's nomination this morning.
He is deeply devoted to the mission of the World Bank. He wants to help struggling nations defeat poverty, to grow their economies, and offer their people the hope of a better life.
As U.S. trade representative from 2001 to 2005, Zoellick was a strong advocate of free trade policies that critics blame for worsening global inequity. Zoellick spearheaded the U.S. campaign to have the World Trade Organization overturn a European moratorium on genetically modified organisms. He was architect of the Jordan Free Trade Agreement, the Vietnam Free Trade Agreement, and the Doha round of World Trade Organization negotiations, which have all but collapsed since then. Zoellick also served on an advisory board for Enron Corporation prior to its collapse. In 1998, he signed on to a letter to then-President Bill Clinton, calling for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Joining us to discuss what Zoellick means for the World Bank is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Mark Weisbrot, what will Robert Zoellick be in a position to do as head of the World Bank?
Well, quite a bit of damage, because one of the things the World Bank has done for the last 25 years at least is attach conditions to countries' loan agreements and even debt cancellation agreements that require them to open up to trade rather indiscriminately. I wouldn't call it free trade, because they also force them to adopt other measures which are protectionist when it comes to, say, the pharmaceutical companies, protection against competition there.
Now, you've written that the World Bank has actually been losing a considerable amount of its influence worldwide. Any possibility he might bring about a change in course on that front?
No, I think it's going to be a tough one for them. You know, he's a neoconservative like Wolfowitz, and he's, you know, very identified with that crowd. He's also, you know, very much represents, he's kind of another symbol of United States foreign commercial policy. I mean, trade reps tend to be fairly pragmatic compared to other kinds of officials, but he's almost at the far end of that spectrum. That's one of the reasons, you know, in terms of being an ideologue, he didn't get much done. You know, the Doha round is not going anywhere, and he didn't get very far in Latin America. The Jordan Agreement, the Vietnam, these were pretty small things. We have almost no trade with those countries. So he was pretty unsuccessful, and I think it's because he's pretty hard line. So I think he's going to have a lot of trouble at the bank. I think the people there are going to have trouble accepting him. I think the rest of the world is going to have trouble accepting that the United States gets to appoint a U.S. citizen to this 185-member organization, the 185 countries or members of this organization, and here is the United States once again appointing a U.S. citizen at the head of it against the wishes of most of the world, as if it were still 1944 when this arrangement was first made.
And the arrangement, as I understand it, is by custom and tradition, not by law. How do you think the board of the World Bank will respond to this particular choice on the part of the United States?
Well, you know, the thing is, the board, you know, Japan just does whatever the U.S. wants. You know, they supported Wolfowitz even in the latest controversy, so it was only the Europeans that couldn't swallow that. But they give Treasury control over this institution, unless they think it's, you know, in the case of the Wolfowitz scandal, they think it's just too damaging to the institution to, you know, to let it go to the institution. But in terms of just having U.S. Treasury call the shots, that's been the arrangement for 63 years. And I don't see the Europeans or the Japanese standing up to them on that unless they're, you know, develops some another kind of scandal or, you know, other real resistance to this.
Mark Weisbrot is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. President Bush announced this afternoon that he is asking Congress to double funding levels for his AIDS relief program. The first round of the program provided unprecedented levels of aid to countries hit hard by HIV. Some global health experts are optimistic about the $30 billion that Bush is requesting to continue. Others are worried about how the money will be spent. Darby Hickey reports from Washington, D.C.
When President Bush first announced his plan to provide $15 billion to global AIDS relief in 2003, it was welcomed by those working on the ground for HIV prevention, treatment, and care. And while no one disputes the significance of the sheer amount of funding that has been dispersed through the program to 15 target countries, 4 years into the plan, HIV advocates are not short on criticism. They felt restrictions on how the money from the plan can be spent, which is tempering HIV advocates' enthusiasm for the new funding the president announced today.
Today, I ask Congress to demonstrate America's continuing commitment to fighting the scourge of HIV/AIDS by reauthorizing this legislation now. I ask Congress to double our initial commitment and improve an additional $30 billion for HIV/AIDS prevention, for care, and for treatment over the next 5 years.
Over the past year, several governmental agencies and non-governmental organizations have issued scathing reports on restrictions within the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. The latest report came last week from Advocates for Youth, which works to help young people make informed and responsible decisions about their reproductive and sexual health. James Wagner, executive director of Advocates for Youth, says that while the doubling of funding is terrific, Democrats need to ensure that money is spent without ideological restrictions.
This is a very important month coming up, and all eyes will be on Congress and particularly the Appropriations Committee. This is where we'll get our first read as to what these Democrats are going to do, and they need to stand up for the facts. They need to stand up for evidence-based public health. And if they don't, it will be a significant betrayal of public health and of the needs of young people across the globe.
Funding for programs promoting abstinence only until marriage is currently earmarked as one-third of prevention money in the president's plan. That earmark, among other aspects of the program, has been criticized by the Government Accountability Office for undermining the effectiveness of the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. Chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, California Democrat Tom Lantos, says he has been calling for an increase in funding, but wants to examine all the restrictions in the current law.
We'll have a full debate in committee, and I am strongly in favor of using the most effective and the least costly approach to dealing with this global tragedy.
Congressman Lantos says his committee will take up the issue before the end of the summer. Currently, funds from the plan cannot be spent on generic AIDS drugs, but instead must be used to purchase the patented corporate versions, which often cost four times as much, reducing the number of people living with AIDS who can access the life-saving medications. Another restriction mandates that organizations receiving money from the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief must denounce prostitution and trafficking, leading many agencies working with sex workers to lose funding. These concerns and more are included in a set of recommendations for changes to the president's plan to be released later this summer by the Global AIDS Roundtable, a coalition of HIV/AIDS experts and organizations. The roundtable is convened by the Global Health Council. Smita Barua, Senior Policy Associate at the Global Health Council, says she welcomes the president's proposal if some changes are made to his plan.
It's important to note that the Global AIDS Roundtable is calling for country flexibility across the board. Right now, I think what we're seeing is a one-size-fits-all policy for all 15 countries and beyond. And I think the most important recommendation coming out of the last 6 months' process is that basically we want PEPFAR to look at policies and tailor them to countries and to communities.
Connecting U.S. HIV policies to a comprehensive U.S. global health policy is also crucial, says Smita Barua, expressing optimism that advocates will work successfully with Congress to improve the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. Those changes could be made this year or next during the appropriations and reauthorization process. The president's proposal for doubling the funding to $30 billion would take effect next year if Congress approves it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Congress members are exploring expanded trade with a close neighbor of the United States, Cuba. Five members of Congress and 250 U.S. business representatives have descended on the island's capital to attend trade talks there. For 3 days, agribusiness executives, food exporters, and farm groups from the U.S. will be meeting with Cuban companies. Jay Jacobson reports from Havana.
These talks take place under the shadow of a nearly 50-year-old economic and financial embargo by the U.S. on Cuba. The sanctions came in 1960 when the Cuban Revolution, led by Fidel Castro, made clear its determination to be free from U.S. political interference and economic dominance. Kirby Jones, head of the Washington-based consultancy group Alamar Associates and a key promoter of this week's talks, says U.S. government restrictions complicate trade with Cuba.
We have a situation where it's legal to trade. Congress passed in 2000, and the President of the United States signed it and became the law of the land to sell food and agricultural products to Cuba. And yet we have a situation where, in practical terms, the executive branch is making the implementation of that law on the land as difficult as it possibly can be.
At present, Cuba can only buy from the U.S. No Cuban products are shipped back on the empty ships that have been bringing U.S. food items to Cuba under an exception of the embargo. Figures released by Alimport, Cuba's chief food importing company, show that since 2001, the island has spent more than $1.5 billion on American farm products, including onerous transportation, insurance, and financing costs. Alimport chief executive officer Pedro Alvarez said the figure could have been easily doubled were it not for the U.S. government restrictions. He lashed out at regulations that force Cuba to pay in cash only and make payments in advance through third country banks. The Cuban food importing executive noted that if the U.S. government allowed Americans to travel to Cuba as tourists, the island would have more U.S. currency with which to buy from the U.S. U.S. agricultural executives attending talks came out against the long-standing policies that obstruct travel and business with Cuba.
My name is Marvin Lehrer. I'm with the USA Rice Federation.
We ask our Congress to lift these trade and travel restrictions.
By lifting these restrictions alone, we will generate more jobs in our country. It will allow Cuba the ability to generate more foreign exchange in order so they may buy more food products for their own people and for the millions of tourists that would surely be arriving in Cuba from the United States.
This delegation of U.S. businessmen to Cuba is accompanied by five members of the U.S. Congress, including both Republicans and Democrats. Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro said the U.S. legislators were in Cuba to learn and seek a dialogue.
We are a diverse group, not only from geographically diverse, but we are also from different perspectives around the issue of an embargo on Cuba. Some who have been opposed to that embargo, some who have supported it. The point is that we wanted to come to Cuba to engage in a conversation and a dialogue, essentially around agricultural issues, interests, but other areas as well.
Today is the final day of the talks. The organizers have announced that the signing of the contracts, worth up to $150 million, will take place during the closing session at the city's convention center. In Havana, for Free Speech Radio, I'm Jay Jacobson.
Two former Senate leaders are trying to shift the role of agriculture in the United States. They say their plan will benefit farmers, benefit the environment, and benefit taxpayers. The plan comes as Congress is in the middle of an intense debate on the nation's farming policy. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has the story.
Two former Senate leaders, Democrat Tom Daschle and Republican Bob Dole, say agriculture should play a key role in climate change. Senator Daschle.
We believe that of all the sectors in the economy, agriculture is one of the premier areas that can make a huge contribution in the effort to reduce greenhouse gases. So in essence, we're adding the fourth F, to the role and mission of agriculture today: food, feed, fiber, and now fuel.
The Daschle-Dole plan endorses a congressional goal of producing 30 billion gallons of renewable fuels by 2020. To do this, they say renewable fuels must expand beyond crop-based, corn-based ethanol. Large numbers of farmers are switching their crops to corn because of market demand. But corn can also be destructive to the environment. So Daschle and Dole hope farmers enter the energy market in ways beyond crops. They're promoting other forms of fuel production, such as cellulosic ethanol. That fuel is produced from biomass, such as wood chips or waste. And they've created a series of incentives, including a $100,000 interest-free loan, for farmers to get involved. The plan goes one step further. It also sets up ways for the farmers to refine and distribute their biofuels. Senator Dole.
There's just another whole area where farmers can reap some income and not rely strictly on crop income. So it's just almost a revolution when you think about farm policy and what it means to the American farmer, or the community, the state, and to the American consumer.
Ben Lilliston with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says the Daschle-Dole plan is well focused on conservation, on renewables, and enabling farmers rather than corporations to own their own farms.
This has been done really successfully on the state level. Minnesota here is kind of has the model for the country, where farmer-owned facilities received certain amounts of tax credits and gave them an advantage in the marketplace over ones that are owned by, you know, a big company. And the result has been Minnesota has really benefited from the bioeconomy, I think, at a much higher level than other states.
The former senators hope to sell their plan to the current Congress. Congress is looking at ways to shift U.S. farm policy, an examination that takes place every 5 years. And the political clout of the former senators from different parties will bode well on Capitol Hill. But many opposing forces do exist. The biggest area of contention will likely come down to finances. Daschle and Dole say their proposal will save $4 billion taxpayer dollars. Senator Daschle.
If we're going to have a farm bill this year, we have to be able to demonstrate that that farm bill can be written at reduced cost to the taxpayers.
Those cuts will happen by limiting subsidies paid to farmers and doing away with direct, unconditional payments. Instead, they'll rely on the markets for renewable fuels to provide the farmers with profit. But some oppose. Tara Smith with the American Farm Bureau, a group that endorses large corporate farmers, says that the financial safety nets are important for farmers.
We think that the direct payments in particular help farmers meet sort of their day-to-day capital requirements on the farm and help support net farm income.
Chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Colin Peterson of Minnesota, has opposed doing away with direct payments, and many of the Southern representatives oppose subsidy cuts. But many competing plans are out there, and the Congress will continue examining its options. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Immigrant rights advocates are participating in the fourth annual Migrant Trail Walk to highlight what they call a human rights crisis. According to one organization, more than 84 migrants have died in the Arizona corridor of the U.S.-Mexico border since October 2006, and the number is expected to increase during the hot summer months ahead. Amanda Schaugert joined the trail workers on their first day.
The walk takes place over 7 days and 75 miles and traverses the path some migrants take through the desert from Sasebe, Sonora, Mexico, to Tucson, Arizona. The caravan of walkers gathered in Tucson's Southside Presbyterian Church, home to the Sanctuary Movement, which provided relief for Central American refugees in the 1980s. A commencement ceremony took place at Nuestra Señora del Sagrado Corazón Church in Sasebe, Sonora, Mexico. Walkers carried 3 mock caskets to represent the men, women, and children who have perished in the desert. The procession wound through the dirt roads of Sasebe, past migrants and the businesses that catered to them. 60 walkers who plan to complete the entire migrant trail relinquished their IDs to group organizers as a further act of anonymity in solidarity with migrants. Walkers on the migrant trail want to call attention to what they say is a human rights crisis on the border. Reverend Del McCormick is with Borderlinks, a binational group that provides experiential tours of the border area.
If people came to the border and saw the numbers of military personnel, I don't know how many Border Patrol trucks we saw today, probably 20, 25, helicopters, I think they'd be appalled to know that we live that way. I think they'd be appalled to know the human violations, human rights violations that happen here on the border as well, not just for migrants, but for people who live on the border.
Melissa Rodas is a Phoenix area attorney who has walked the migrant trail all 4 years.
I feel that we're on this walk as a pilgrimage in solidarity with migrants and in order to recognize the suffering that they go through. You know, often walking 5 and 6 days with a single gallon of water and, you know, not having a map, not knowing their way, being exposed to, you know, criminals and bandits and, you know, often 98% of the women that cross in the desert have been raped. I've worked with a lot of immigrant women in my law practice, and most all of them have been raped.
Over 4,000 migrants have died in the Arizona desert since the inception of Operation Gatekeeper in 1994, which began funneling border crossers away from major ports of entry into more treacherous terrain. The protest walkers seek to bear witness to this tragedy. They are well supplied with food prepared for them by community groups, and their gear is carried in support vehicles. Water will be provided to the group by Humane Borders, a faith-based organization that offers humanitarian assistance to border crossers by maintaining more than 70 emergency water stations on and near the U.S.-Mexico border. President of the group, Mark Townley, says the walk gives participants a taste of what it's like to make the trek.
It demonstrates kind of a little bit about what the migrants go through. Obviously, these people are much better supplied, and they have us taking water out to them every day. But it kind of shows sort of what they go through. This is a long, long hike across the desert. It's a long way. Even well supplied, it takes a lot out of these people.
The participants of the hike were invited by organizers and their allies. Walkers included college students from as far away as Washington and Colorado, a Mennonite pastor from Brownsville, Texas, as well as local border area activists and students. The first 2 miles of the walk on the U.S. side passed through Sasebo, Arizona. Here, many houses in the small town often have their yards fenced with concertina wire. Kat Rodriguez of Coalición de Derechos Humanos is one of the lead organizers of the migrant trail.
You know, a lot of people don't really know how they feel about a lot of the issues going on, immigration, border, reform, no reform, fence, no fence, wall, no wall. But sort of the human part of this, I think, connects a lot of people, and they realize this is about humans, this is about, you know, death, and this is about mortality and about the fact that, you know, we are responsible for each other, whether you like it or not.
Walkers set up camp in the Buenos Aires Wildlife Refuge for the first night. Later in the week, they will resume walking on the highway that leads into Tucson. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Amanda Schager in Tucson.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Ada Bogado.